Thank you all for coming. I got the impression during the last couple of weeks, just talking to some of you, that we haven't exhausted the subject, so I thought it might be interesting to look at press coverage of string theory before this Mullen and White books appeared, and just from the beginning. So I did a search and found, I have to qualify that, I said in my email that this is the first time the word superstring has appeared in the New York Times, the first time at least since 1981, which is when they begin their electronic database. And until just a few years ago, after every paper came out, they employed a core of people in a big room, and they would take multiple copies of the Times, and they would cut it apart with scissors, and they would file each article into a little envelope by subject and if it was a person, you know, there'd be a Schwartz, comma, John, physicist folder. And so there might be a string theory folder. And when they discovered the computer, they stopped. Yeah, they called this the morgue, where all stories are sent to die. And they moved the morgue out of the building on 43rd Street. I think it's in a warehouse somewhere in the greater New York area. So there may be an earlier reference to strings.
But you can search the earlier stuff. Now.
Yeah, you actually can't.
Yeah. That, only in the last few months.
Yeah, that's right. I knew they were working on that. Yeah. Oh, so we can do that.
Yeah, we can.
Thanks for mentioning that. So 1985, just to remind myself how long ago that was, I did a quick check, and Ronald Reagan began his second term as president in 1985, and Gorbachev became the head of a political entity that was known as the Soviet Union. I also realized from some of your biographies that some of the people doing superstring theory now would have been like 10 or 11 years old when this came out. And like Walter Sullivan, who's one of the great old New York Times science writers, who still writes for the Times from beyond the grave. Because as you may know, we do obituaries in advance, so they send around lists of people who are getting on in years, and they keep them on file so that when the sad day comes, that they pass on. They pull out the story and call some of their colleagues and update it. And run it, and they still use the byline of whoever wrote it, including Walter's byline, and he died about 10 years ago, and just this summer he was back in the paper again. So. I mentioned in a review I wrote of some books, one of which he had been connected with, but it just sort of reminded me of, I like to think that Walter Sullivan was sort of beckoning these scientists, back into some 10-dimensional universe where he's looking down. But anyway, so this is the first time, as far as I can tell, that we had superstrings in the New York Times. And some of you have read this before now, and I think this is it's a pretty classic newspaper story. I mentioned before that you have what we call the lead, L-E-P-E, and the lead being a number of leading physicists are beginning to suspect that everything in the universe is made of strings. And that just shows you how this was the first story. And then, going down and, getting the usual quotes from someone kind of outside of the main part of the field to put it into hopefully a bigger perspective. I see picked Frank Yang, and then I was just struck by how many of the same themes are in this story as appear later on. The fact of, well, no, there's not experimental verification yet, but it's just, this is just so beautiful and elegant, and our instincts are telling us that something like this is probably going to be true, or at least point us toward the truth. And the usual history with Kaluza-Klein and then supersymmetry. So I thought nice basic story on this. And the next time, now a couple of years later in 87, we have Casey Cole, who many of you know, down in Los Angeles, and I guess comes up here quite a lot. And it's on your advisory board, is that right?
Is that first word a spelling error?
Oh, where's that?
The very first word, lead.
Oh, no, you actually lead. Oh, yeah, they did. Oh, yeah, they misspelled lead, and lead is L-E-D-E in journalism.
Friday. I think I mentioned that one.
You did. Not long ago.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought this was a really nice piece of writing, and I think most of us who do things like this are looking for, you know, opportunities to write about something interesting, but also to really, you know, do what we hope is some interesting writing. And starts with a nice. I'm sorry that doesn't quite fill out the screen. I just don't have the. But yeah, you can get the idea. You know, that nice little portrait of Ed Witten. And I sort of remember reading this when it came out, and that was actually the same year I started at the Times, and in the Sunday Magazine. They used to run more science than they do now, and this was just a nice portrait of Witten, and then using the portrait to really tell readers, you know, many fewer of whom knew then and know now that there's something called super string theory, and that some of these interesting people are very excited about it. But is, you know, again, like with Walter Sullivan's story, I think it's really, you know, rather nicely balanced. You know, she captures the excitement here, and of course there's the usual quotes about, you know, Witten's brilliance and eccentricity, and he kind of becomes a character in the story. And, you know, of course, this is the sort of thing that leads to a certain amount of mythologization in any field, you know, whether it's sports or science, where people start emerging as stars, and I mean, for good reasons in this case, but also because he's, you know, clearly an interesting character, and K.C. Cole is a good writer and kind of brings that out. And explains, you know, quite a bit of, you know, the basics of what superstring theory is. And again, you know, makes it pretty clear, I think, that, you know, that people have no idea how they might test this, and then it's going to be a pretty long road ahead. But just met many of the same, you know, Witten being modest, and many of the same themes that we see in stories, you know, all along. They all, you know, they all go back to the, you know, the Schwartz and Green, and at some point, I mean, it's almost like the history becomes kind of canned, or little icons and things that just always get repeated. I think this is the first story I saw that had the quote about string theory being a bit of 21st century mathematics, or 22nd? That it, yeah, right. And it attributes it to Ed Witten, which I also attributed it to Witten in the next story here, but then I noticed later that it's now attributed to someone else. So we'll see that. Okay, so that's 87. And then from what? You know, we had some, you know, little bits and pieces of things about superstring theory. And the next time we really picked up on it was in 98, after the so-called second revolution. And this was the point where Dennis Overby had become the deputy science editor, and he just asked me to do something on superstrings, which I think I mentioned in an earlier session. And I hadn't really been following it. I just remembered, you know, I'd remembered the, you know, the paper by Glashow and Ginsberg when they compared superstring theory to theology, and I just kept thinking, wow, you know, this thing with the 10 dimensions and the compactifications, and found it all very mysterious. And then I was fascinated when I started reading it to just see how much had been done with M theory, and I just became really, you know, very enthusiastic about it, and tried to just catch readers up basically on what had happened since they may have last tuned into the story. And then, yeah, with the great Maldacena dance that we looked at before. So this sort of seems to be the height of the enthusiasm in our coverage. And you know, still I think with the necessary, you know, qualifications and problems, and then trying to explain metaphorically the ADS-CFT conjecture stuff, and you know, that was really, really hard to, you know, just get something. A lot of times I feel like when I'm writing these, you're just giving people, including myself, the illusion of understanding, just like using enough metaphor to say it's sort of like this, so you can kind of get a foothold and and move up another rung. Yeah, and there's our own Steve Giddings, who was quoted at the end of the story, and used this. This was kind of a funny thing I mentioned in the end. Steve was using this nice mountain climbing metaphor, and then mentioned that he was going off on this really scary sounding expedition at the end of the week. And then after it appeared, Steve told me that maybe that kind of, you know, it wasn't really as bad as a 1,000-foot vertical wall of ice.
1,000
vertical feet. Vertical feet, yes, right. Yeah, I mean, it sounds like, yeah, I mean, yeah, it wasn't, it was step back a little, so, yeah, so it was just relieving. You know, so I was pretty happy about this story, and it was one of three stories that got the AAAS Science Journalism Award in 1991, and it was just really aggravating to find that someone who did a chart with the story, you know, kind of to put this into the perspective of the history of physics, made all these really, really kind of trivial but embarrassing errors, like Edmund instead of Edwin Hubble, and yeah, there was another one too. They misspell Schwartz, and, you know, Martin, and, you know, unfortunately, yeah, so, but anyway. That usually doesn't happen in the graphics, because they have, like, someone at Science Times now, I haven't worked with the newest instantiation, but they really are reporters as much as they are graphic artists, and they actually get on the phone and interview people, and usually work pretty closely with the reporters. Okay, finally, this is really the last time, and it was back in 2004 that we had something really major by Dennis, and this is starting to. It's interesting. It doesn't mention White, and I can't remember if it mentions Lee Smolin or not. Maybe toward the end, but you know, it's just really something Dennis wrote. I know he was out here, and then I guess he was at the Aspen String Conference. So this is the first sign I can see that now, you know, the story seems to be going in this natural cycle. Well, where first there's Walter Sullivan saying, you know, here's this, you know, really weird stuff for all you science junkies, and then you know, it just gets better and better, and you have all these kind of stars and mythology surrounding the history of this new field, and then you kind of reach the point where it's like, well, you haven't solved all of the, you know, features of the universe now, the secrets of the universe, and then there's a certain amount of backlash, but or at least second thoughts or sobering. But it's, I think, done. I mean, it's all quoting people like, I guess the main person that this is really, really dependent on is Lawrence Krauss, and he had started, yeah. So, but again, you know, it seems very balanced to me, and really a story that's expressing what's in the air, not the journalist's opinion, because I don't think, you know, Dennis would feel any more qualified than I would to make any kind of judgment, but on this matter, and you know, just really using it again as an excuse to kind of tune in and remind people what's happening, try to bring out some of the human elements, and just write about these problems, and you know, a certain sense of disappointment that it's taking perhaps longer than some of the more optimistic people would have hoped. Oh yeah, there now it's Dr. Daniel Amati who once said a piece of 21st century physics. So who knows? And then back into the history. So I was surprised to find that there really hasn't been anything in the Times about the Smoit-Wolin affair, if you want to call it that, except for the book review that Tom Siegfried wrote that, you know, was very negative about the book. So I'm kind of surprised that that hasn't been in there. And Brian Gring did a piece reacting to it, even though there was nothing really about it that's been in the Times. And it shows you how, yeah, I don't know why that fell through the cracks. And one possibility is, I know when they were trying to find someone to review the book, they had trouble finding a science writer who didn't know Lee, and which would disqualify them. And I know Dennis went to Lee's wedding, so they wouldn't assign the book. They wouldn't assign the book to him, and I mean his previous wedding. And but they, you know, and then they, you know, and I couldn't review it because I reviewed it for Scientific American. But I don't think they would have probably assigned it anyway because the Times standards on that are much stricter than most places. They usually ask you, do you know this person at all? Have you ever, you know, had any contact with them? And some contact's okay. And the big question is, well, is there any reason that the author, when he sees your byline on the review, might either be overjoyed to see, oh, good, he's reviewing my book, or immediately have a cardiac arrest? So, so they really try to get someone that's very disconnected. And I know they went through four or five people and settled on Tom, and so that's how these things work. But I don't know if Dennis maybe, I'm just making this up because I haven't talked to him about this, but I don't know if Dennis might feel uncomfortable writing about this because he knows Lee too well. But then there are other people who could do the story. But, you know, stay tuned. Maybe something is in the works. So just wanted to, you know, just show you the trajectory, and it's, I think, fun to go back and look at how these things were viewed over time and, you know, just use this as an opportunity to get some of your comments maybe on what you think we do right or what we do wrong when we cover these stories. I mean, we're always in the position of writing and interviewing people who know vastly more about the subject than we do, and yet we like to think we have some expertise in being able to translate this into a language that people, you know, a general smart reader will find interesting and clear, you know, without distorting the science too much. And as I mentioned before, it's that feeling of having these two groups reading over your shoulder with completely different goals and expectations, and then editors who are usually more interested in making it clear to the reader and don't really have the expertise of fact checkers. And so does anyone want to chime in on this point at this point and see it?
Just a question for you, which is regarding, well, you mentioned that maybe there should be more coverage of the whole Smoy affair.
And maybe we could just use their real names.
Okay, yeah. Smolin and Voigt. The question is, if it's already been reviewed, at least Lee's book, to what extent do you think it is newsworthy?
Well, yeah.
Cover it more, and what do you think ought to be covered?
Yeah, because there's a question of whether they're just, you know, whether Lee and Peter Voigt are just setting an agenda by publishing the books, and that you don't necessarily have to agree that it's newsworthy and react to it. So, you know, so very possibly it was decided that Dennis's story really brought up, you know, in a non-inflammatory way some of the same issues and put them in perspective, and anything else would just be hyping the books and increasing sales. So, yeah, that's a good point.
I think there's a really significant extent to which maybe it didn't fall through the cracks. I mean, maybe sometimes not weighing in on a particular fuss issue makes a positive contribution in itself.
Yeah, well, it always raises the question. You know, people wonder, well, you know, everyone else has written about this, and it's good to be immune to that, but, you know, there's always pressure from the editors. You know, they see something in Time magazine, and it's like, well, why aren't we writing about this? And then we have to convince them that maybe there's nothing to write about. So, I don't know. I could see it
either
way.
Whether the things that you could write about are not so
hasty
in terms of...
Yeah. I mean, a book review is a good forum for doing that, but on the other hand, the book review is an opinion piece, so... You know, it's really not a news story or an analysis so much. Yeah, anything about how many do you read Science Times or? Yeah, you know, I just be interested in that. One thing I usually hear from scientists is that, well, I think you really do a good job covering all these other fields, so I can, you know, keep up with what some of my colleagues are doing. And but you really make you get a lot of stuff wrong about my own field. I feel the same way when I read a review of one of my books sometimes. It's probably a similar feeling, like, what? See?
But George, maybe you could say something about when things get onto the front page, out of the science section,
yeah.
the
sort of philosophical things. Because, I mean, today it was the mice drinking red wine.
Right.
You know, that definitely deserved to be on the front page.
Again, I can only talk to my what's currently a fairly loose association at the Times, but I once did have the privilege of sitting in what they call the page one meeting. And it was when I first started there, they give you kind of an orientation, and you get to sit in all these other sections. And every day, the top editors at the Times gather in this room, and there's someone from the science desk, someone from the national desk, city desk, world desk, and sports desk, everyone, and they're saying, what the big stories are today, what their people are working on. And some of them will say, we have a story that's really good, and we have it scheduled now to run Tuesday in Science Times, but we think that this is a big enough deal that we're going to offer it for page one. And then there will be a discussion, with the other editors. And, there's only a certain number of stories they can put on page one. And then they'll have these very erudite discussions, both on trying to judge the newsworthiness and also what will be of interest to readers. And they try to get a mix. So, just pick it up and it's all international politics. Or, of course, you'd never have to worry that it might be all science, probably. Most people who work in newspapers, English majors and humanities majors, and a few of them have a little science background. But, so they decide not only that, but then with this lapidary skill, they decide that, this story will be in this position with such and such type. And in this story, to kind of hit to the reader that it's a little light, we'll use, some other typeface. And they just go, it's a huge, some of the, really smartest people you'd ever meet sitting in a room deciding this every day. And it seems kind of sad to me that now, you go on the web, and the way I usually read the papers, I see what the most emailed stories list is. And it's kind of like editing by the masses. So all of this great effort, I wonder how long that's going to last. I mean, the idea was that you were paying when you buy a copy of the Times some extremely smart people to sit around and tell you what they think is the important stories today. It doesn't mean you necessarily agree with them, but it's at least one good take in that. And now it's kind of, voting by the mouse click, I guess. When that happens, it's you'd think that would be a great thing to write a story, submit it to the Science Times, and you're waiting for it to run on Tuesday, and then they decide it's so important they offer it for page one, and it's only happened to me a few times, and it's just horrible. It's just the worst news you can possibly get, because suddenly you have to finish, the story. Maybe you have two or three more days to kind of leisurely go through and, send emails to Steve Giddings to ask him to explain this again to make sure I have it right, and other sources, and then it's just, drop dead deadline suddenly. And then you get moved into a whole different editing track with editors you've never worked with that don't edit science stories a lot. And you usually end up having to, like, Science Times is assumed that it's picked up by people who are, sort of interested in science. And if it gets into on page one, there's a sense that it has to be even more broadly accessible. So, you use the word particle here without defining it. It's a terrible thing, and you lose control of the story often, because with Science Times, they'll send me everything I write very last second before it goes down, so I can read through it and make sure it hasn't been changed by some well-meaning editor. But you really lose control of that when it goes on to page one. The next day, I don't even pick up the paper. I just kind of look at it, see, see what they did to your lead. Yes, great.
If we could just stipulate for a moment that this little excitement over these two books will be really short-lived, just a little blip, then I'd sort of like to ask you or the string theorists, particularly the string theorists, what their view would be on how important has all this past coverage been for the field? I mean, would it be in essentially the same place it is today without the enormous number of articles in the Science Times and books that have been published? Did it make a difference to the way things evolve?
Yeah, as far as funding or attracting people to the field, or that's an interesting question. I mean, how much of what we do is just intellectual entertainment for people who enjoy reading about ideas, and how much of it actually, has a shaping effect?
You say funding, but if memory serves, that if we were talking about QCD, for example, the standard model, a lot of years went into that too. Maybe I've forgotten, but I don't remember the continual barrage of stories during that period.
That's probably true. That would be an interesting thing to see. It wasn't followed at such a microscopic.
But one thing perhaps that indicates that, I don't know how important the media coverage is for scholars. I haven't lived in this country for the last 6 years, so there might be things I'm missing. But I would think that it's not a primary driver of the health of the field. The associated media coverage is like a second order effect of some kind. The only reason I think that is simply that, if you look at the amount of time that an academic spends on, producing research papers or teaching classes or reaching out to the public or engaging with the news media, the engaging with the news media part is not a well-rewarded activity in terms of the academic job description, is it? So, if we don't strongly couple to the news media, how would it be important?
I think the biggest effect of this, it's something I observed in our department and a lot of senior people have observed, is that it used to be that every bright young student came in and wanted to do what Einstein did, and then after the middle 80s or early 90s they wanted to do string theory. So if you were going to get the bright students, you had to have string theorists. So every department started to build a faculty of that, and I think that was a media driven in part effect, because these people would come just from their undergraduate years and be very familiar with that, and ask for who could they work with.
There's not a lot of sources out there for interested students who may be thinking of going into the field, and of course we can try to wake them up to
the magazine articles and the newspaper ones and their stuff.
Four articles in Scientific American or New York Times. They're very important. I remember they were important to when I was a kid learning about the subject.
Yeah, Oliver?
Yeah, I mean, when Andy said about being a kid, I think it's true that the media and the popular press make impression on people before they become undergraduates. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was 12 years old when this first string theory article came out, and I probably didn't read that exact article, but I did read popular science books when I was an early teenager, when I was aware of what was going on, and it probably did affect what was interesting to me and where I would end up going in science. And it's just one data point, it's just anecdotal, but I have wondered lately, if someone just like me was 12 years old right now, would they be pushed in the opposite direction from string theory because of the climate at this very moment? And maybe there's other things interesting, but I do think it affects the sort of pipeline much earlier down in the sort of next generation of scientists and what they perceive as the future of the field.
Don't worry, they're too smart to be pushed the other way.
But, one student, I actually...
Well, no, I mean, I couldn't agree more with what Gordon says, that, I mean, it strongly impacts what incoming graduate students at UCSD, for example, want to do. I mean, almost all of them want to do string theory. And, there's a positive to that. There's a strong negative. I mean, I've seen a number of students over the last 15 years who are bright young men and women who have a future in physics but don't have a future in string theory, even though they're obsessed with it and want to have one. And they've ended up just falling off the map and leaving physics. Perhaps they don't have the requisite mathematical genius that is required. So there is a downside to this, which is
pretty apparent. But can I comment?
Can I comment on the student?
Can I just respond quickly to that? I think it's positive, at least what I've seen, in the sense that a lot of them quickly learn that isn't what they really wanted to do. It was just sort of the thing that got them there. So some of my best students have rebelled against the formality of it and said, I want to do something where they can touch, experiment a little bit. And
it might have nudged them into the field in general.
Right, that's what I've seen. So I think the net effect is positive. And they spread out quickly for us, at least.
So, a couple of thoughts. First, on Matthew's point, it's hard to tell if that's really the press or, Brian Green or
our colleagues at other institutions, they're all effects that come into that, and it's hard for me to see, you know, for example, dealing directly with some of the students, exactly where that's coming from. But a couple of other comments about just data points, really, about how press and stories affect them. One is that it does seem that certain parts of funding agencies do appreciate these things. They like the visibility and so on, that, you know, if some attention is called to the field and so on, they seem pretty pleased about that. One other data point, well, just in general, one other data point is an interaction I had with a certain institution, which will remain unnamed, and some of the members in other fields outside of high energy theory of that department were expressing the viewpoint, well, gee, if we could just hire Ryan Green, we would be. Okay. So, clearly, even as physicists, people's impressions had been formed based on the fact that he'd written a very famous popular book, and stroke theorist finds it great stroke theorist, but he's, you know, the thing he really stands out for is most of all is the book.
So another thing related to this, people coming in, just grad students only want to do string theory. I remember in the New York Times, though I'm afraid I'm not going to know the author or the article, a comment about what was going on in physics.
Yeah.
What was going on in physics actually meant what was going on in high energy levels.
Right.
And that distinction was not really made.
Yeah.
And I have colleagues who are condensed matter theorists, astrophysics, observationalists, you know, whatever, and I think people do get irked, not just the string theory, but high energy physics in general, because it can have the popular perception as being much more important overall in the field than the actual researchers in physics feel maybe because it's fundamental physics.
Yeah.
It gets more of the pie in the popular mind than maybe it deserves. And I think that may be part of the reason why you have kids wanting to go into this one area, because that's what they're told before they even get to grad school.
Yeah, I think you're right. I'm not sure why that is, but it's always been true, I think, that high energy physics in one state or another has been covered way more than in other areas of physics. And, I mean, I can think of very few articles I've done on solid state condensed matter. All I can think of offhand, and this might be wrong, is that it's harder to write about it's messier, there's not as many great principles you can really condense easily.
I guess I remember reading.
Give it an effort more, and then maybe you'll find out that's not
the case. I just make a remark. I actually consulted some students. For example, a significant sector of the graduate student population at my own institution was because the easiest for me to get in touch with. And I asked them, what do you think is occurring because of this Swallow affair? Do you think that it's going to put people off from applying to graduate school? Do you think we need to do some, you know, spin control or damage control? Or what do you think is going on? And one student made the very interesting observation, well, perhaps actually this controversy will draw more people into the field, not fewer, for the reason that they may believe, well, this stuff's still to discover in this area. Mm-hmm. It's not like it's all settled and we're just going to work out the details.
Yeah.
So I think if handled right, perhaps our community does need to make a response, not quickly and high frequency and non-linear and shouting at people or insulting whoever, but if we make some kind of response, proposal for a type of response, maybe it'll end up being a positive for the
It's not exciting
just
to be
saying it's not all negative.
Yeah, no. Things are still up in the air, and a lot of people have this naive view of science who know nothing about it. It's like in college where it's all kind of shrink wrapped and done, and you don't get any of the interesting history and the paths that led to various theories. So, yeah, I think that's a good point.
Doesn't this come back to controversy sells again on all levels? If Matthew's field had a nice, hot, juicy controversy going on, do you think that would be in the press?
Well, controversy and also, more generally a story.
The reason it's harder, I think, to perhaps find a good story in something like condensed matter physics is that in condensed matter physics, you know, there aren't that many people working on one problem. You know, people are working on this problem, that problem, this. You know, a lot of the problems do maybe, you know, in interweave in some fashion, but everyone's kind of in their own, you know, predominantly in their own area, whereas, you know, in string theory, everyone's working on one problem. So I think that's the main...
That's too coarse a grain of...
Well, I know, but I'm using the same coarse graining when I compare the fields, and that's what I'm saying.
It's perception from the other side of the Atlantic. In England, there's a strong... There's a very wide perception among particle physicists that the astronomers, astrophysicists, cosmologists are much, much better at handling media coverage and generating it than particle physicists, and there's far more on, you know, there are far more television programs about black holes and, you know, cosmological phenomena than there ever are about string theory. I mean, I don't think I couldn't say for sure, but I don't think the White and Smolin books are even on anybody's radar in Britain.
I think it is primarily an American class.
I mean, I think it's American. Yeah.
You've got a local singularity, which is Stephen, in this area of generating coverage.
Mm. Oh, well, yes. But it's not. No, it's not all down to him. There are regular television science programs, and the number that are dealing with, you know, beautiful and startling ideas from the astronomy part of PPARC. See, the tension is that in Britain, science funding is split at the top to all of science except particle physics and astronomy. And then particle physics and astronomy are fighting for the big piece of the pie, whereas all the other bits of science are fighting for the rest of it. So there is a lot of tension between particle physics and astronomy.
That's quite similar here, too. You have the Planet of the Month phenomenon in the Times and places, and NASA has a $2 or $3 million budget just for advertising, whereas particle physics, it's higher than that, you're right. And particle physics refuses at NSF and DOE to allow any money to be spent on publicity. So there's that's a good story. NASA can spend this fortune, and we can't. They literally will not allow it.
Even if you go beyond like how much money you're spending on it, I think astronomers in general have spent a lot more time trying to make their field sound catchy. I mean, take the example of the acronyms they use versus the naming of supersymmetric particles. The acronym is very boring sounding, whereas you have machos and wimps, and, you know, they created this sort of story in just the words you use to describe science.
But don't underestimate the use of super. I mean, supersymmetry, superfluidity, superconductivity. I mean, when I interviewed graduate students, maybe even before super strings, and they all said, I want to work on supersymmetry. And if you said, what do you know about it? And the answer would be absolutely nothing. But super.
Because
you say to them, what about diffractive scattering? And they say, no.
Takes advantage of the word super at those in Santa Barbara Mexican restaurants.
I think the other part of this, which probably gets hidden, is that people in general have an attraction for things which appeal to the sort of romantic side of you know, something in their past is almost like watching a fire. You're sort of drawn to this view of things, and whether you're describing the fundamental beginnings of the universe, or the ultimate fate of the universe, or the origins of life. The parts of science which I think naturally appeal to everybody, which have to do with origins and the ends of things. And so someone who comes up with a new idea of superfluidity or pattern formation in fluids has a much harder time explaining to people why that is relevant in a greater view of life. Someone who comes up with an idea of tunneling between universes, or, you know, where do particles come from, or the origin of time, it's much easier for people to relate to that, even if they know nothing about it, but there's something sort of romantic about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, given that physics is, you know, supposed to be an experimental science.
Yeah, but that's not what appeals to people. It's not purely intellectual.
It's not abstract.
There's an emotional side too.
I mean, I have found a big appeal. Is, you know, people's interest in quantum mechanics, even if they don't really know what it means. I mean, that's
mysterious.
There's a lot, the mysterious aspects of quantum mechanics, and that's an area which, in you know, which outside of astrophysics and particle physics and string theory, could be perhaps emphasized more in the press. I mean, Bose-Einstein condensation, which has been in the press a fair amount, but you know, the quantum end of solid state physics is, you know, something which at least has the word quantum in it, and you know, it can be made interesting, you know, to those people that are interested in the manifestation of quantum mechanics in ordinary things.
But. Yeah, no, it's
super quantum. I was going to say that some of the decisions about what to do in the field really are not just scientific decisions, and they really are properly in the political world, where the newspaper is a very important agency for getting information to the right people. So, for example, the question of whether to do this repair on the Hubble Space Telescope, which has a scientific part, it has a political part, it's a financial part, it has, you know, it's all these different things all mixed up. You know, that's something where the news stories and the editorials and all of that stuff kind of is connected to the real science stories as well, but they're not exactly the same thing. I think that's legitimate in a case like that, where there needs to be a public decision to spend $1 billion and risk 8 people's lives. You know, there needs to be a public discussion.
So how do we get a piece of that for particle accelerators?
The stand in the beam.
You align the beam with your eye.
Well, there are only certain things that physicists can control, right? We only have a certain coupling to politics.
Well, you're asking people to spend these big sums.
Bob is politely making the point that they're managing to get this done by getting the public involved, whereas we haven't succeeded in that in any other area. From condensed matter to particle accelerators, we have not been able to get the public involved. That's why they're getting the Hubble telescope extended, and they're getting one after that, and we're not.
Well, on the contrary,
he was politely saying it, but
well, we feel that things are getting constrained and worse very fast.
Sure.
You know. There was a certain amount of public hostility to the FSC back in those days. Mm-hmm. The people that I'd run into that weren't scientists at all that had a clear opinion about it, and usually it wasn't favorable.
We can't get a favorable view somehow.
But I think that's legitimate, not the particular view, but that ought to be a public discussion. When, you know, it's this question of how should I spend $10 billion.
It's $10 billion, you know.
That's fair.
Well, then, are some areas of physics better at engaging those public discussions and putting them forward? And are the stories told better by some areas of physics? And where does that responsibility lie between the physicists, the press, the PR machines that could be engaged? How do you make that happen for scientists?
Yeah, it works both ways, and I know at Science Times it's driven a lot just by the curiosity of the individual reporters, and of course there's efforts made to see what areas of science are there and who's going to follow these journals and cover this, but so much of it is just driven by, you know, a reporter talking to the people he or she talks to, and then suddenly, you know, lighting on with something that sounds like a good story, a good thing to write about, and selling it to the editor. So, and I don't know how true that is in other fields, like business coverage, if anyone, you know, business editors have more of a big overview, and they can kind of say, well, this is neglected, this subject, or, yeah, I mean, it works both ways. You know, we like to think that as journalists, we're a mirror reflecting what's going on in society, but of course it's not that simple, and you get all these non-linearities where you're, you know, the distorted mirror inevitably, but it's how you allow for that.
But it is not an equal landscape. I don't think you can expect the public to be uniformly equally interested in all areas of science or sports or media. There's things that appeal to people, and things in general that don't appeal to people, and that's just
one of the hardest things to fight as a science writer is just the continued pressure to spend more of the space on medical news, and you know, there's certainly at least a perception that this is what people want, and so many newspapers that had good science sections that have become kind of medical and technology, and and probably very few editors are thinking about, you know, how that's actually not really science. And, but something, I think it was Marty mentioned that our first session is, you know, we're talking about, everyone's always lamenting the disappearance of all these newspaper science sections, like the Dallas Morning News, San Jose Mercury, but, you know, really, it's kind of extraordinary to think that, you know, these papers writing for, you know, a certain small piece of the world would be covering science, which is always not just a national but an international story. So maybe it just makes sense that it would filter down to having two or three publications that are national or international that are covering science for the general public, since it's so easy now for anyone to read this stuff on the web, and, you know, just leaving newspapers to cover their little local stories, which are just as important, to have no other outlet.
One observation somebody else made already that might inform that is we heard from our friends at Atlantic Cosmos that the whole coverage on different parts of science can really depend on where you are geographically on the planet. Mm-hmm. I mean, so the coverage in Canada is not the same as the coverage in the US. Mm-hmm. You know, the phenomenon is different in Britain and so forth. So perhaps studying the differences in how different, you know, countries' media report on the same scientific framework or thereabouts might provide something useful. I mean, for example, the only reason I mention it is that the phenomenon of women's participation in physics, particularly, that some of the mysteries and not understood things in the field became really clear when there were delegates from 70 countries making presentations about the phenomenon in their part of the world. Mm-hmm. I don't know, maybe the international comparison might...
That'd be interesting. I mean, it seems inevitably that's going to wash out just along with the globalization of everything else.
Well, you might think so.
Homogenization, maybe not. Well, anyone else? I think it's probably kind of reaching toward the end here. Okay, well, thank you very much. That was great.